in the Creek Room this morning is Don Coberly. Today's session number is 99-2 and is titled Geology and the Earth, Part 2. I found some green stuff in the fridge. Do you want to eat it? Let's listen in to Don.
Under the heading Geology and the Earth, where the roots of the tree of life begin. And the title of today's session is I Found Some Green Stuff in the Fridge. Do you want to eat it? And the primary reason I named it that was so that people would laugh and look, read it on the board, and then say maybe they would come down and see what the heck I was talking about and how that would somehow relate to geology. The point being that if you're sitting in the living room and somebody yells that to you from the kitchen, my thinking is you want to ask them, well, what's this stuff made out of? If it's grapes, that's okay. If it's a ham sandwich, probably not. And what the age of the material is, how long has it been in there? And so since today we're going to talk, two of the things we're going to talk about are the age of the earth and the composition of it. That's kind of the connection I see. So for those of you who weren't here yesterday, I'll try to recap what took me 66 minutes yesterday into 2 minutes today. Starting with the formation of the universe, and I choose the word formation rather than the word creation because I don't know that science speaks to the creation of the universe. I think it talks to the formation of it through a model that that scientists believe because it explains what we think we see. So 12 to 15 billion years ago, there was a huge explosion that is sort of commonly called the Big Bang. And from whatever point that originated, there has been an outward explosion, and that explosive force has caused the universe to expand over the last 12 to 15 billion years. The only other really competing force with that outward explosive force is the force of gravity, which is the attractive force between any two things that have mass. That initial explosion was inconceivably hot and powerful, and the material was incredibly, unimaginably dense. And in the first bit of the history of the universe, was light only with a little bit of particle matter. With that expansion came cooling. Things weren't so closely packed together, so the universe began to cool, and in time nuclei, first subatomic particles and then atomic particles and then nuclei, it was cool enough for those things to sort of precipitate out or come into existence, depending on how you read the mathematics. And the initial composition of the material that was formed was primarily hydrogen, which is the most common element found in the universe, and helium. Those were the two primary things that were found. After some period of time, depending on who you read, 300,000 to 700,000 years, it became cool enough for the electrons in the field to become attracted to the protons and the neutrons, and now you no longer had nuclei, you had atoms. At that point, there became enough, things got big enough that they could have a little bit of gravitational attraction towards each other. Since space isn't perfectly the same everywhere, it has little inhomogeneities in it, it has little currents and little eddies in it, there were little places where things could sort of clump together or move into a location sort of like a pool in the stream where it's quiet and things can collect. Gravity sort of takes a bigger effect after that, and it's sort of a perpetuating cycle that once you get more material, there's a little bit more gravity, so anything coming by, some of it or more of it clumps into these little areas. At some point, a couple of billion years later, the math says that it was permissible mathematically for galaxies to form. How galaxies are formed is unknown. It is one of the remaining problems in astrophysics. as written by a guy who won a Nobel Prize, so if he doesn't know how it happened, we're not going to figure it out. So that formation of galaxies is unclear. Within the galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, the one that we call home, at some point, the solar system that we belong to started to form. How that happened is not completely agreed upon. The most agreed upon hypothesis for this is that there was a sort of spherical cloud of gas that formed some way we're not sure of and began to rotate some way we're not sure of. And with that rotation began to collapse and spin more rapidly, collapsed into a flat sort of disk shape is what's hypothesized. Most of the material was collected at the center through the attraction of gravity. At some point, that material became dense enough that material is primarily hydrogen and helium, that became dense enough that the thermonuclear reaction could begin. The sun was born, and the formation of the planets, the best supported hypothesis suggests material sort of precipitated out at various distances from the sun based on the density of the material. That heavier material, as this disk that created the sun cooled off, it became cool enough for things to precipitate, and denser material precipitated closer to the sun. Anything that was light, the sun provided enough heat to sort of blow it outward further. So that when you look at the planets that are relatively close to the sun, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, they are rocky sorts of planets. Mercury is believed to be made out of primarily iron, which is the heaviest of the common elements in the universe. You get out to Earth and it's primarily silicon and oxygen with iron and nickel, somewhat lighter stuff. And then when you get out to the big planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, those are made out of gas primarily, water vapor, ammonia, things like that. So that covers from 12 to 15 billion years ago to about 5 billion years ago, which is sort of where we left things yesterday. And this formation of the planets is hypothesized to have been, the mechanism is from these little things that precipitated out. They precipitated out as little grains or blebs first, and enough of them sort of fused together to make chunk-sized materials, and then enough of those chunks ran into each other to make what's called a planetesimal, which is sort of a mini planet. And at some point, that mini planet had enough gravity, had enough mass to generate gravity, that then as it swept through its rotation around the sun, it sort of collected up things that were nearby it. And that's kind of where things quit off yesterday. So that's where I want to pick up today and start with the early evolution of the Earth. Someone can point out to Marvin that I have an alliteration up there, I think, which only came to me after I wrote it down. So we start with this planetesimal Earth, sort of this proto-Earth, and it was at that point believed to be relatively cold and also relatively homogeneous. If you would take the Earth and cut it in half and have these two cue balls, you know, split in half, when you would look through it, it would be primarily the same stuff at the surface as it is in the middle. Compounds of silicon and oxygen and iron and magnesium were the primary things that made up the Earth at that time and still make up the Earth. And then events, things that happened in time, indicate that the temperature of the Earth began to rise. So what are the mechanisms by which the temperature of the Earth began to rise? The first one is these collisions that, here's our little planetesimal Earth running through space. How does it get bigger? Well, it gets bigger because stuff runs into it. Comets and these other chunks of stuff, as the Earth is sweeping along, things run into it. Well, with those collisions, there is a large amount of energy. Think about the hypothesized comet impact 65 million years ago that, in theory, wiped out the dinosaurs. a catastrophic event in the history of the planet. Well, in the early days of the planet, that was happening relatively frequently. A lot of that material, a lot of that heat was radiated back out towards space, but some of it was collected inward to the Earth. That's the qualitative picture, that's the mechanism. How do we quantify that? It's impossible, but we can think about the things that would be involved there. The speed at which that collision took place would be one thing. The mass of whatever it was that hit the Earth, a small thing would generate less heat when it hits the Earth than a big thing would. The frequency, if things were happening very regularly, the Earth would collect up more heat, and if those bodies had some heat associated with them when they collided. The second heat generation mechanism is the mechanism of compression. As the Earth collected more material and got larger, it had more gravity, more force towards the center of the sphere, and the overlying weight of new material being added. The best analogy for that is when you use a bicycle pump and you take a volume of air and you smush it down in the bicycle pump. When you do that, you decrease the space for the thing, for the molecules inside to run into each other, so there are more collisions which generate heat. Same sort of idea, that as the Earth was compressed, more heat was generated. The third thing is radioactivity. Certain Earth materials, uranium and thorium being the two largest percentage, but potassium as well and other materials, are naturally radioactive. They spontaneously disintegrate, they spontaneously come apart and form a new substance. Uranium goes through a chain of decays to become lead. With each of those disintegrations, some particles are given off. Those particles run into whatever else happens to be next door to the uranium, and it's the same concept on a much smaller scale as the first thing we talked about, where stuff runs into the Earth and generates heat. In this case, something very small runs into the molecule next to it and generates heat as it hits it. So there are three mechanisms that are responsible for generating heat and increasing the temperature of the planetesimal to, at some point in its history, probably through this accretion, the collision process, and through the compression process, there's some indication or some guess by somebody that the internal temperature of the Earth was about 1,000 degrees centigrade. At that point, radioactivity, one of the things about radioactivity is that it's not a big source of heat. I mean, radioactive decay of a chunk of rock, because it happens so slowly and because there isn't very much of it, it doesn't generate a lot of heat. But if you don't generate a lot of heat, but you generate it from a really big body and you generate it for, say, a billion years, you can, the total is, there's quite a lot of heat there. For those of you who weren't here yesterday, feel free to ask questions whenever something comes to mind, because that'll give me a chance to get a drink. while I think of how I'm going to dodge your question. So, the collision and the compression take place fairly quickly or fairly early in the Earth's history. Radioactivity is a very slow but ubiquitous process, because at that point the Earth is not differentiated. Another thing is that rocks generally don't conduct heat away very well. It's insulating. And so any of this heat that was trapped initially by this collision process, if enough stuff got in on top of it, it was sort of like having a hot zone with a thermal blanket or a blanket on top of it, so that heat then wasn't radiated back out into space. At some point, probably after about a billion years. So this planetesimal idea, in time, is thought to be about 5 billion years ago, plus or minus a little bit. That's what's represented here as 0 years. And so, again, this is a schematic of the temperature at any point as you increase depth in the Earth. Here's the surface of the Earth, and here's as you get deeper and go towards the center of the Earth. At the surface of the Earth, this represents the temperature. The temperature rises reasonably quickly. Think about it the other way around. It's as you get relatively close to the surface that most heat is lost. Down towards the center of the Earth, one little particle is almost as hot as the one next to it because there's really no gradient to get rid of heat. It's only when you get to the surface of the Earth that there's a big temperature difference. So as you go deeper in the Earth, the temperature increases fairly rapidly and then stays reasonably constant. This is the proposed sort of shape of the curve and value of it due to this collision energy and compression energy. After a half a billion years, radioactivity has generated this much additional heat, and after another half a billion years, 1 billion years total, more heat has been added, and so the temperature has increased from its original state. Also shown on this picture in red is the schematic of the melting curve for iron, which is simply, this is 1535 degrees centigrade, which is the melting point of iron at atmospheric pressure. The temperature increases as you go deeper, simply because more material is sitting on top of the iron. When you melt something, what happens when you melt something? You take it out of its solid phase and you make it a liquid. What does that mean? Well, in the solid phase of most materials, the internal structure is very ordered. You add energy to that and you break the bonds, and now there's a little bit less order, and what used to be solid now flows. That's the way I think about it. So it takes more energy to overcome everything smooshing this solid into place when there's a bunch of weight on top of it. So if it's at the surface, it's relatively easy. As you go down, you've got stuff sitting on top of it, things are packed tighter together, you've got to add more energy to get them to split apart. So that's why the melting curve increases with depth. At about a billion years after this planetesimal has formed, it's hot enough for iron to begin to melt. Now, prior to that, probably some of the other materials, the silicon and oxygen, have melted or become relatively plastic. When iron melts, iron is denser than those other materials. So now you have heavy liquid material sitting in a relatively liquid, less dense material. That heavier liquid is going to sink. And in one of the textbooks, it talks about how these little droplets of iron start to sink. Well, they're little droplets of iron if you've drawn the Earth this big. If you take the Earth at its full size, there are these huge, blebs or globs of iron that melt and start falling under their own weight towards the center of the Earth, because that's where gravity says they should go. And this is, it's another one of those things, since the Earth is so big that it's sort of hard to imagine the scope and the scale of that, how much material there was that was doing this falling. One of the, as we finally get to this point and iron starts to melt, this is another one of those sort of kick-starting cycles. Once the iron starts to melt, as the iron would fall towards the center of the Earth, it would release more energy, the same way that water at the top of a waterfall has more energy than water at the bottom of a waterfall. As that water comes over it, it's not related to it changing in mass or anything, it's only because of the change in elevation that you can generate energy from that. Here at Old Village, village, they take that energy, convert it to hydroelectric power, and run overhead projectors and other stuff. So as this iron would begin to melt and start to head towards the center of the earth, it would release energy as well. The only source for that energy to go to was into heat, and so it was one of these sort of, once the cycle got started, it only increased in things got hotter faster, essentially, and began to increase the internal temperature of the planet from 1,000 degrees centigrade to 2,000 degrees centigrade, and now all kinds of things were happening. As this heavy iron was heading towards the center of the Earth, it necessarily had to displace some other stuff out of the way. And there was a sort of density-based differentiation of the planet. And so the whole point here is that at one time, what was a very homogeneous, consistent planet from center to edge is now a chemically zoned and differentiated planet with iron at the core and other material going outward from that. And I've got some handouts, the first of which sort of gets into that topic. Before we talk about that a little bit, in yesterday's sort of introduction to the session, I said one of the things that I would do as the week went on was try to alert you, step back one more step. One of my ideas about this, about being here and doing sessions, is that you have some interest in geology or you wouldn't be here. You're not going to spend your entire life at Holden Village, and therefore whatever most geology you do, you're going to do someplace else. If you're interested in reading books or watching videotapes or taking a course at a community college, that's going to be done someplace else. One of the things that I think I can do, since I've spent a long time looking at geology, is sort of give you the best resources so that you don't have to stumble through and reinvent the wheel that I did by trying to figure out what the good books were and what the bad ones were. So yesterday, in talking about the Big Bang, that's not a whole lot of geology, but since about the time we started talking about the solar system, and now all of today's stuff and from now on will be mostly about geology. And there are two very good introductory geology texts, one called Earth by Crescent Seaver, and you'll see a number of your handouts have these guys being credited. Those have all been photocopied directly out of this book. And another one called Putnam's Geology. This is probably about its fourth edition. And these are just two very, very good introductory geology textbooks. If I did have one book with me, it would be one of these two. One advantage to Putnam's is it costs $28.95 as compared to $48.95 for the Earth. So if that's a consideration. This internal Earth stuff that we're talking about and what we'll talk about next, the structure of the Earth and the seismic evidence, is sort of in the realm of what's called geophysics. And there's a book that was that came out a couple of years ago called Naked Earth, The New Geophysics by a woman named Shauna Vogel. And this is the best book I've read like in 5 years probably. Or read three quarters of, like over the last 6 weeks when I was supposed to be writing my sessions. At one point I got panicked enough that I put this down and started doing work for this. But it's just, what I really appreciate in my reading is people who can explain things clearly. And this, people who do explanatory prose well, who take things that aren't well known and make them clear, that's just really compelling to me. And in this case, being in sort of the field that I spend a lot of my time. So this is just a superb book. I highly recommend it. on the back cover, it says, in a beautifully crafted work that is at once impeccably authoritative and wonderfully accessible, Shauna Vogel provides readers with new explanations to ancient mysteries and the latest geophysical hypotheses. Just as Jacques Cousteau made oceanography a romantic and swashbuckling enterprise, Vogel opens a window to the turbulent world beneath our feet. That's a little overhyped, but really a good book. So, if you're interested at all in this next bit of stuff we talk about, excellent. All right, the structure of the Earth. We go from this homogeneous planet to one that's been differentiated, and that I have a slide for somewhere, just not here. Well, okay. If I could have a copy of what I gave you all.
I had a question.
Okay.
As the lighter liquids are displaced and moving upwards, as the heavier liquids are moving down, and they're cooling because they're reaching the, they're getting closer to the surface. Why don't, as they become more solid, why don't they start to sink again? Why isn't there just a continual cycle of convection? Why does it become somewhat static? Is it cool too quickly to sink back down?
Okay. This sort of gets into a point that maybe I should have made already. When the Earth is solid, or when solid material dissipates heat through conduction, right? One little molecule is hot, so it makes the next little molecule hot, so it makes the next. And that's a really inefficient way of getting rid of heat. It takes a long time. Once the Earth became mostly liquid, now convection can take place. And convection is the idea that sort of cycles get developed from whatever this thing is that's hot and bubble. It's the way water boils. You have heat at the bottom and the temperature gets cooler, so you develop these little cells inside your pot of boiling water, right? So that the really hot material comes to the surface and starts to cool and goes back down. Convection is a much better way of getting rid of heat. And so after some period of the Earth getting hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter and becoming liquid, now you can get rid of the heat better. The planet cools back off to some degree, and now there is, and in the early history of the Earth, it's thought that small bits of crust started to form and then were sort of resorbed into the mix. And as from this 1 billion years after formation to 2 billion years, things had cooled off enough that now that solid material could be maintained out at the surface. So it's the change from conduction to convection. Thanks for bringing that to me. In this upper left portion, if you hold it this way, this picture shows sort of a zoned Earth. And starting from the center, it says there's a solid iron core, and outside of that is a liquid iron core. The only reason that we think that the bit in the middle is solid, the temperature is certainly hot enough for it to be liquid, but again, it's that overlying weight thing. There's just so much pressure keeping those iron molecule or iron atoms together in the structure that although it's hot enough for them to be melted, they're just sort of still stuck in place because of the overlying pressure. At some point, that pressure becomes, it decreases as you move out from the center. At some point, it gets, there's not so much pressure and the temperature allows the iron to become molten. The next sort of zone out is what's called the mantle, which in this diagram is made up of the lower mantle and the transition zone, and a thing called the asthenosphere. I think sthen is either Greek or Latin for strength, and a meaning no. So that as the asthenosphere, the thing to remember about that is that it's sort of plastic. It's not real rigid. And we'll leave that for now, but it will become important in what we talk about tomorrow and Thursday. And then as you get closer to the surface is the lithosphere and the crust. Excuse me. So the outermost layers are this plastic asthenosphere, the lithosphere, which is rigid, sort of sitting, floating in the lithosphere, and there are two primary types of crust, one called continental crust and another called oceanic crust. Yes, sir?
I don't know if this is sometimes visual images would help for me, and I don't know if people, I like to think of this sort of as a salad dressing kind of thing. If you think about salad, oil and vinegar, and you put in some light, you know, some seasonings and stuff like that, and shake the whole thing up, it's all mixed up, but if you let it sit, one of the heavier stuff goes to the bottom, and you get a visible layer on top, and then all the little spicy stuff, they actually float up on top because they're so buoyant. So it'll differentiate out that way, and that's a lot of it. Isn't that similar to the difference of densities of things? So you get the kind of plastic, flowy stuff down below, and then you get this flaky stuff up on top that's kind of rigid, that becomes the crust.
Okay, structure of the Earth. We go from a homogeneous Earth into a zoned, a layered Earth. Why is it we think that? Why is it that geologists or geophysicists think that? And what is it that makes us think that there is, at some point in the Earth, there is a liquid layer? This study, this bit of geophysics that talks about that, comes primarily from the study of earthquake waves that have been recorded by seismograms throughout since they were invented. I don't know when that was, start of the century, something like that. Plus, in the 40s, late 40s and early 50s, supplemented by all the underground nuclear explosions. When an earthquake happens, energy is radiated outward from the place of the earthquake. There are two primary kinds of waves that are generated with an earthquake that radiate out through the Earth. And I'll try and... One is called a compression wave, also called a P wave. It's, I think, from Latin for prima or primary. It might be Italian. And the other kind is an S wave for second or seconda or however you say that. Two primary kinds of waves, P waves and S waves. P waves are compression waves, and they, in the direction that the wave is traveling, things get squished together and then spaced back out, and that's how the wave is generated. And I have a high-tech visual here to help try to illustrate the point. I didn't know slinkies were made in plastic till Friday afternoon in Wenatchee when I was looking for a slinky. But if you sort of jolt the slinky, you can see that a wave gets generated, and it's by compressing the spring, and then the spring expands, and that compression and expansion sort of goes down the length of the slinky, or goes down the length of the Earth. So that's a compression wave, and those get generated along in an earthquake. The other kind of wave that gets generated is what's called a shear wave, which is sort of if you take a rope and tie an end to the wall and then sort of snap it back and forth. Or if you're sitting in the bathtub, well, no, that's a bad analogy. That won't work. I think that snapping rope is a good analogy. The thing about shear waves is they don't travel through liquids. One of the characteristics of a liquid is it has no shear strength. And if you want to prove this, next time you're sitting in the bath, if you do that piston action P wave, you can generate waves that will go towards the end of the tub and come back and slosh out onto the floor. Or if you do it in the hot tub, and tell people you're doing a science experiment. At the same time, if you use a shear wave motion, those shear waves don't propagate out towards the end of the hot tub and come back to you, because the water just sort of moves with no resistance to your hand. It's a property of the fluid. It has no shear strength. So there are these two different kinds of waves, P waves and S waves. S waves are generated through a solid but not through a liquid. So we have an earthquake that happens here, and there are earthquake recorders all around the planet. And in some places they get both P waves and then S waves, and in some places they get only P waves and they never see these S waves. And they figure out what is going on here. And so after a long period of time of this happening, somebody came to the conclusion or ventured the hypothesis that at some place as you go through the earth there has to be a liquid layer, that these S waves get transmitted through the solid, come to the liquid, and then they just die out. The other big issue that has come out of earthquake research is this idea of the earth being zoned. And how do we explain that? And one, just sort of the most conceptual level that I can talk about that at, is the observation that at certain places on the planet, you didn't get any P waves. We have an earthquake here in Holden Village, and you go about a third of the way around the world, and no matter how big the earthquake is here, they don't get any readings there. How the heck did that happen? And this again was something that the first time that there was an earthquake and somebody recorded it, nobody knew anything about it. It's only through putting these seismographs everywhere over the planet and then having a bunch more earthquakes happen and being able to have a big mass of data that people began to understand this. What is it that causes that shadow zone to happen? When earthquake waves or P waves are generated, they sort of ripple out from the center of from the epicenter or from the focus, sort of like ripples in a pool if you throw a stone in a pond. They go out in all directions. And so here are P waves being generated and traveling through the earth and being recorded at some seismograph station someplace else. What I guess it was sort of a back idea. People first found that at certain degrees, if this is 0 degrees, this is it shown on your figure? 104 to 130 or something like that. 110 to 140, there's this shadow zone. How do we explain that? If the Earth is completely uniform and it's only a density difference, there would be different speeds, but you wouldn't expect to see this. So what's the hypothesis for explaining that? The hypothesis is that there are various layers inside the Earth that have different properties for the transmission of waves. When a wave, whether it's a light wave or any other kind of energy wave, if it gets to a boundary where the material is different, it will be refracted at that boundary. It's, in light, it's called Snell's law. It applies in hydrogeology as well, the thing that I study, where the way water moves as you go from one sort of medium to another sort of medium. The way I think about it is if you go from a medium that transmits things reasonably well to one that transmits it less well, the ray, the wave, is bent so that it goes more vertically and less horizontal. It takes a longer time to get through it. It's about the only way I can think about it. So here we have a series of waves being generated out, and this one right here is the last one that comes down through the earth and doesn't hit what we now know to be the outer core. The next one hits the core, or hits that boundary, is bent more towards the vertical of this unit rather than the horizontal, goes into the inner core, goes back to being more horizontal, goes back to the liquid outer core, becomes more vertical, and then comes back out. The next wave over does the same thing. So there's some shadow zone. We find that it's based on where this seismogram is in relation to where the earthquake was, and having some zonation to the planet, and particularly a liquid layer helps, is the best model that explains that, so that's the one we're going with. I've also shown on here a couple of shear waves, one being generated and coming out, since it's always in solid material, one heading towards the liquid layer and then just getting killed right there, not being able to be transmitted by the liquid. So that's the seismic evidence for there being a layered zone planet. We don't need to deal with that right now. So that's the structure of the Earth and the evidence for it. I want to talk for a couple of minutes about the age of the Earth. It's currently thought that the Earth is about 4.6 billion years old. Why do we think that? Why do geologists think that? They think that mainly because most of the asteroid material that we collect up is of about that age. Thinking that the planet being formed of these planetesimals and asteroids being relatively the same material as the planetesimals, it makes some sense that the Earth would be of that age. So, excuse me a minute. We'll talk for a minute about some evidence as to why that gives us some comfort, at least that is in the right ballpark for an age. You don't have this, I don't think, in your set of handouts, but I want to show it to you. Okay, this is an overhead. This is a series of rocks that are sort of stood up on end. These are layered rocks that are stood up on end. Somewhere right in here is a surface, an irregular surface, and above that is another set of layered rocks which are tilted off the horizontal. This is the place called Hutton's Unconformity at Sicker Point in Berwickshire, Scotland, and what is thought of as the birthplace of geology. The place where geologists have to go home to, like golfers have to go to St. Andrews and where Lutherans go. Is there Minneapolis? Right. One of the things that's most interesting about this to me and the science that I work in is a guy named James Hutton went there in 1788 and sat there and looked at the rocks and saw the rocks that everybody had seen beforehand and saw something completely different about it. And it's like Newton getting hit in the head with the apple and going, okay. Or Copernicus looking at the same things that everybody else looked at and seeing things differently. It's a revolution in science, and I think it's a really neat thing, sort of almost on a philosophical level. What is it that he saw and what did he interpret differently? Prior to 1788, there were two events in geologic history, creation and Noah's flood. Time's up, pencils down, that's all. Either created that way or Noah's flood made it that way, and that's it. The age of the Earth at that time was felt to be about 6,000 years. Through a careful study of the generations of listed in the Bible, Archbishop Usher in 1650 calculated that the Earth was created in 4004 BC on October 26th, at somewhere between 9 and 10 o'clock in the morning. I think it's 9, Jake thinks it's 10. Now, right. And on the face of it, it seems a little silly. The caution for me from that is that Archbishop Usher was making best use of the tools that were available to him at the time and doing things in good conscience. And that's the answer he came up with. And I don't see any difference between that and what I'm trying to do in my daily business, trying to do geology and trying to do science. I think we have better techniques now. I think we may not be constrained by things that he worked with, the Bible being the filter through which everything must pass and be found acceptable or unacceptable. But he was giving it his best shot with the stuff he had. That's all I'm doing. So that's the part that when I think about things, I sort of go back to and say, all right, that's the reality. What Hutton saw is that these rocks that are stood up on end at one point had been flat and had been laid down by streams. And so something had to happen to tip them up on end. He also saw this thing, and he called it an unconformity, which is some break in time. The third thing that he saw was another whole bunch of rocks on top of that that had been laid down and then tilted up as well. And to him, he felt that this 6,000 years that the Bible indicated was just completely insufficient for things like this to take place, or we ought to be seeing them happen every day. We ought to be seeing beds sort of go up before our eyes for stuff like that to happen, and he didn't find anything in the evidence for that. So he said the earth has to be way older than 6,000 years. Make a long story short, the next estimate that was, I guess the first estimate was made by Lord Kelvin, the guy they named the temperature scale after. And his ideas were based on cooling of iron spheres, because that's what he did, and he applied that to the earth. And he was well enough known and intimidating enough that nobody questioned him. And then the discovery of radioactivity at about 1900 made a new heat source, and therefore the age of the earth could be expanded out from there. And then this idea of radioactive decay allowed for some measurements to be made, and the first number that came up from there was 500 million years. And from there we have sort of stretched it back in time to the oldest rocks on the planet being 3.7 billion years old, and the pretty common age for asteroids and space material that hits us that we can get our hands onto it of being 4.6 or 4.7 billion years old. Now, four point six billion years in comparison to today is essentially inconceivable. I take that as sort of a starting place. So what I did was try to come up with a picture for myself, and then something that I could share with other people as to how do we compare human time with geologic time scale. And I started thinking about it, and I said, okay, let's take human recorded history, or whatever we want to call it, and let's make it a page, right? Let's make it one sheet. And let's figure out how many sheets old the Earth is in comparison to our one sheet. So the first thing I had to do was, what's this recorded history I'm talking about? I settled on 4000 BC. I think it's coincidental with Bishop Usher, but I don't know. And I sort of went back through my ancient history book, and 750 something is Rome founded, and 2500 is the Sphinx and the pyramids, and 32-something is the Mayan calendar starts, and 3700 B.C. is the Jewish calendar starts, and 4200 B.C. is the Egyptian calendar starts, and before that, there's not a whole lot. Jericho is 7500 B.C. It's the first walled city, but nothing much else. So I took 4000 B.C. as sort of the start of human or recorded history. So everything from, you know, whatever brackets you want to put on human history, from stone wheels to Teflon, is within that 6,000 years and is within our sheet of paper. So if this is 6,000 years, how big is the stack for Earth history for 4.6 billion years? And so one thing you need to figure this out is how much that 6,000 years right there, this is 500 sheets and it's 2 inches, so 1,000 sheets is 4 inches. And if you want, you can write down a little number in the corner of your piece of paper. And we'll do the math real quick because it's actually pretty easy. 6,000 years in a sheet, 1,000 sheets, which would be two of those stacks, would be 6 million years. Just times it by 1,000. How many 6 millionses are there in 4.6 billion? Let's make it 4.5 billion, because it makes the math a little bit easier. As it turns out, you take 6 million into 4.5 billion, and you get 750. That's how many packs. How many double packs of paper it would take. 750 packs of paper at 4 inches, which is a third of a foot. If this is human recorded history, the Earth is a stack of paper 250 feet high. When you go out the door, it's 250 feet to the Hike House sign. Go up and stand on the corner of the dock and go, okay, yeah. And as I was explaining, the first person I explained this to is not a scientist, but he works with people. And he said, yeah, and we're the last sheet. And it sort of helped really put things in perspective. So, I don't know, that's an analogy. I mean, the age of the Earth is incomprehensibly old. It's inconceivably old. If somebody grasps it and internalizes it and realizes it while they're here in the village, I'll know, because their hair will start on fire. That's the way I think about it. But that's the age of the Earth in comparison to the things that we know. Yes?
And I just suggest, as you may have already talked about, are you going to talk about how you actually get those numbers?
How you get
4.6 billion, and I mean, what's the process where scientists actually establish those ages?
That radioactive age dating?
Yeah. Did you talk about that already?
Let's talk about radioactive age dating and how...
Wait a second.
This is Dan, also known as my plant. I don't know if we're going to get to that yet today. Let's talk about the geologic time scale. The scale that we use, now that we have this 4.6 billion years, we have to have some way to name it. We need to break it down into years, into months, into days, so we have things to talk about. And I do have an overhead about the geologic time scale, and you do have it in your package of things. And why do we need to have a geologic time scale? And so that we can sort of place things in time, so that we can put them in order, so that we can see what's related to what and what caused what. And if you don't know the order that things come in and you don't know where they sort of fit in time, you can't say one thing might be related to another. geologic time scale is broken up into, I don't worry about eons, I worry about eras and periods and epochs only in more recent time. So three primary eras, Paleozoic, paleo meaning old, Mesozoic, meso meaning middle, and Ceno meaning recent. Any Latin students that know that? And then periods within each of those, think of these as being months and weeks, something like that. So that we could put all geologic terms in 450 million years ago, 225 million years ago. And you'd have to keep all these things in your head the same way that we could say, well, you know, on day 45 last year, it was this way. And then on day 265, we went to, that's when vacation started, right? We do the same thing by saying, we're going to split things up into January, February, March, April, May. Here, geologists, since they've got longer periods of time, we just have bigger bits, but we still use, you know, months and weeks. So we have these, and these are things that you might have heard of, Jurassic Park, the Jurassic era, things like that. This is just it's a framework by which geologists can talk and place things in time. Now, easier to read that way. And my suggestion is, if you want to study geology any further, sort of casually, if you know the Paleozoic, Mesozoic, and Cenozoic, and you know the period names, and if you know the epochs of the Cenozoic, you'll be okay, because that's what I know, and I've been doing it for a long time. If you know more than me, that's great too. So the question, or a little thing I'm going to pass along to you is, mnemonic, is that what you call it? A mnemonic. Or how you can remember the periods of the geologic time scale. And the way I learned it back in geology school in 1977 isn't really appropriate, so I sort of twisted it around a little bit to hold it. Can Oscar snowboard down many pointed peaks? Tina Jones can, Tina's quick. If you can remember that, you can associate that with Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian. We split it into Mississippian and Pennsylvanian here in the States. I don't know if in Canada they think they're North American like us, or whether their allegiance is back to Britain, where they talk about the Carboniferous. They're still mad that we left, and so don't recognize Mississippi and Pennsylvania. That's the first letter of each of the periods, which is why it's useful. So this is maybe a little silly, which is part of the point, so it'll stick in your head. And then if you can take that, these letters, COSDMPP, Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian, Mississippian, Pennsylvanian, Permian, Triassic, Jurassic, Cretaceous, Tertiary, and Quaternary. That will help you keep things in order. So that's the geologic time scale. It's the calendar by which geologists operate. The only difference is, rather than months, days, and years, it's millions or hundreds of millions of years for each of those little pieces that we recognize.